This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture with me, Dashran Johan. So let's think for a second about these following day-to-day occurrences. A couple of kids are fighting at the playground. The dad watches, chuckles to himself and says, "Well, boys will be boys." A man looks at his new female co-worker, shakes her hands and says, "Welcome. And by the way, your behind really looks good in that outfit." And then just casually walks away. The woman's teammate tells her, "Get used to it. They mean no harm. Boys will be boys." We've heard that phrase thrown around a lot, but is this something biological, something that's inherently in us men, or is this just a sorry and lame excuse? Is it just simply toxic masculinity? So to discuss this with me, I have on the line Sharon A. Bong, the Associate Professor of Gender Studies at Monash University, and Sivanandi Thanindaran, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, also known as ARRO. Let's start with you, Sharon. First of all, what is masculinity in the conventional sense?
I think there is nothing conventional about masculinity, and I say that because masculinity, at least in the context of gender studies, which mirrors masculinity in our lived realities, is largely a construct. What that means is that its meanings and how it's lived shifts in different contexts, you know, different specificities, particularities. But traditionally, most people would understand masculinity as associated with boys or men. But of course, masculinity could also be associated with women. So you have female masculinity, for instance. And generally, masculinity, in terms of common understanding and also how it's lived, refers directly to, you know, one's experience of a masculine gender. And one's expression, gender expression as masculine. So the way you walk, the way you talk, for instance, your general deportment, it could go down to your food choices, even what you study, you know, at university level, and other sort of traits. You know, one sense of gender identity is need not be aligned with the sex that one is born at birth. So although most people tend to associate masculinity with a male sex, but that's not always the case.
So this is that eternal debate, right? So is it biology or is gender or masculinity a biological construct or is it a social construct? And, you know, over the years here, when we as human beings are interacting with the world, right? I mean, we have our own concepts and our concepts come from stories that we've heard, histories that we have witnessed. And, you know, and sometimes there is some form of, I think, ideas or leitmotifs that occur in masculinity from traditional thought to current thought, you know, and I think the overriding leitmotifs could be like some ideals of strength and courage and independence, right? Mm-hmm. So we could see that, I guess, I mean, and since I studied English literature, so I think this part you can see from the ancient Greeks and Romans, right? I mean, the mythologies of heroes and adventurers and voyagers and, you know, and coming from this time, many hundreds of years ago, of battling societies, right? And what being able to protect one's territory, which included land, wealth, livestock, and dare we say, at that time, you know, to that list, you know, women were part of the property. This, again, is reiterated after the Greeks and Romans, you know, through the medieval times of, you know, the knights and the concept of chivalry and courage and honor. And later on, you know, kind of was distilled into, you know, the 20th century type of what it means to be a man, which is making an economic contribution, right? And at the same time, having independence is athletic, you know, and aggression is seen as a strength, as a marker of manhood.
Okay. And both of you brought up something similar, which is the idea that masculinity isn't something you're born with necessarily, but it's more of the ideals that you sort of embody. And then my follow-up to that would be, is masculinity in and of itself bad?
For me, I mean, either all of these are categories, right? So masculinity and femininity, you know, they are like concepts that are idealized, right? And for me, it works like a box, you know. I mean, just like men may struggle against being defined inside a masculinity box, I mean, women also struggle being defined inside that femininity box, right? And in that, you know, it takes many of us many years to kind of unpack that box and to learn to be ourselves, right? That itself is a journey and a struggle and a continuing struggle for many. You know, whether you fit in the box comes with rewards, and if you're out of the box comes with repercussions or punishments, you know. And more than that, it's also, I think for me, it limits a person's potential. So would we have been different? Would we have grown differently? Would we have explored different things in life if we were not taught for so many years to fit into that box?
I mean, I agree with Sivananti's point. And to add on, there is something very limiting about the way masculinity is locked in with femininity. So in gender studies, we call that a binary or dualisms. And it's interesting that Sivananti, you know, made a reference to the days of Greek, because within Western philosophy, that is basically how we understand masculinities and femininities. So what makes it reductionist or, you know, sort of a little bit more simplistic is the fact that they are locked in a binary. And then what becomes problematic is that there are specific traits that are encouraged in boys, and conversely, there are those traits are not, you know, encouraged in girls. For instance, strength, aggression, you know, which is admired in boys, then becomes something else when a girl demonstrates strength and she, you know, gets all kinds of labels at the workplace in terms of women's leadership as well. So what Sivananti had said about impediments or how abilities are curtailed, you know, talents are wasted. So that would be an outcome of such understanding, you know, the whole economy of binaries. And the when you step out of your place, you know, the repercussions that can befall you are very real and can be very cruel. And even at the playground, actually, so children pick up these messages from adults, you know, to put someone in their place. Of course, there's nothing inherently bad about or toxic about, you know, masculinity in and of itself.
Then my next question to you would be, when does masculinity become toxic? What's the difference between masculinity and toxic masculinity?
I'm so tempted to throw the questions back at you, Dashrin. I guess the difference is the degree of separation, and when certain traits become so, you know, adulated in society, that aggression, you know, aggression becomes something that is celebrated. So there you would have then that embedded in cultures. So the sort of culture, for instance, that tolerates rape, that, you know, goes around victim blaming and excuses gender-based violence. And because that kind of aggression is largely associated with masculinity, and as long as, you know, masculinity aligned with a male is not challenged, so then, as global statistics show, women are experiencing, you know, in very disproportionate levels, and of course in a very different way, sexual and gender-based violence. So at that point, like a tipping point, you know, the sort of traits that one associates with masculinity then becomes toxic because it feeds right into rape culture, victim blaming culture, and so on and so forth.
Right.
So I'd like to also reiterate what Sharon said, because I think she put it so beautifully. And I think that, you know, so when does that spillover happen from masculinity to toxic masculinity is basically when, you know, that concept of masculinity brings harm, right? And it brings harm to your own self, I mean, or to the man himself, to his family or the women around him, or to society at large, right? So when does that aggression, is that aggression sometime, you know, manifest towards yourself, right? In the standards that you set for yourself, and you become depressed or suicidal, or you do certain risk-taking behavior that you wouldn't do, or it manifests as violence against your family members and your spouse or your wife or your girlfriend. Or, for example, if you organize as gangs who go to threaten certain communities. So I think that's when the spillover from masculinity comes, it becomes toxic.
Okay, I've always heard this argument being thrown up, you know, is it then wrong for men to, you know, aspire to be stoic? Is it then wrong for men to be aggressive when playing sports, to be passionate, especially when you look at sports where there's a lot of combat or close contact, for example, like football, where the sort of aggression is generally celebrated as passion? What are your thoughts on this?
I don't know, but I was like thinking of, I'm not sure whether it was Roland Barthes or whoever who, you know, said like sports is the modern combat, right? So the aggression that was on the battlefield is now channeled onto the sporting arena or the sports field, right? But, you know, actually, Darshan, I'm very curious because, you know, when I think about sports, I mean, it's just not about being stoic and being aggressive, isn't it? I mean, nowadays, sports is a lot about mental strength and mental agility, understanding strategies and tactics, and, you know, understanding your opponents so well, or having insight into your opponent's behavior, which are, you know, perhaps traditionally perceived as feminine qualities, or being intuitive, right, about the game. So, I mean, like, so I would say that, you know, to be good at sport today, I think the prevailing paradigm is to be both masculine and feminine at one level. That's my take on it. So I think it's some of these qualities we can even see in female athletes themselves. If we look at the story of Mary Kom, who is a female Indian boxer, right? Mm-hmm. So she channeled her passion and her aggression into a very unlikely sport, which was boxing. Right. And it lifted her up from poverty to like international stardom. And she's on the globally recognized as a boxer. If I'm not mistaken, she's the best boxer in a category for like 3 years, world champion for 3 years or 4 years running, you know. And yet when you think of an Indian woman, you don't think of a boxer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is an interesting analogy, how particular kinds of traits that we tend to associate and celebrate it only because it's associated with masculinity spills over into sports. But I think this sort of aggression as well, to me, is problematic. We could put a label of masculinity over it, but it's not reduced to that. But we find that, you know, this also translates at the corporate workplace, where, you know, that sort of drive for the profit margin, you know, to increase profit margins is something that is also celebrated, for instance. And of course, if you look at it wider, beyond the gender field, that also has to do with the way we are handling, for instance, the ecological crisis. To me, when you take a step back, it's all basically linked. The way, you know, human relations are handled that are premised on very inflexible still, you know, notions of what makes a real man. And it always impacts on what makes a real woman. You know, our sense of sexism, racism, even homophobia and transphobia, all of these play out in also the way that we manage our resources and are at one or not with the environment. There are, you know, larger, wider implications for these gender constructs.
Okay, for now, we do need to take a quick break. But when we come back, Sharon Sivanandi and I will continue our discussion on toxic masculinity. This is Live and Learn The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm Dashran Johan, and I'm joined virtually by Sharon A. Bong, the Associate Professor of Gender Studies at Monash University, Malaysia, and Simanandi Tanindran, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, also known as ARRO. So before the break, we talked about the difference between masculinity and toxic masculinity. So now let's hone in on the concept of toxic masculinity itself. Both of y'all mentioned that whether it's just plain old masculinity or it's evil stepbrother, toxic masculinity, you are not born with these traits, right? So why is it that a lot of boys and men grow up being obsessed with the idea of hyper-masculinity? I'm talking about things like being obsessed with your penis size, being able to fight, you know, having sex with multiple women as something to showboat, as some sort of conquest. Where does this stem from?
Okay, so I think that, you know, I mean, we talked a lot about the sexual conquest and the violence aspects of it, you know, mm-hmm. and where does it actually come from, right? So, you know, I think that the concept toxic masculinity was firstly, I mean, studied in prisons. I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, Sharon. And this idea of extreme self-reliance and going side by side, the domination of others, right? So these two go hand in hand. So the kind of idea that this dominance of others, which includes other men and, of course, women and girls, right? So which feeds into the idea that I need to be able to be strong. I need to be able to stand up for myself. I need to be able to protect myself. And I need to be able to have as much conquest as possible, right? So mm-hmm. I think that that's what it has transformed into nowadays. Because we have to also, I mean, I think that what Sharon had said was like to kind of look at where that toxic masculinity has, you know, kind of spilled over. You know, it's a culture that is existent in the corporate workplace or in many workplaces, really. And, you know, even in the way that, you know, policy making around climate change takes place, this measure of manliness, you know, and this standards that is upheld about dominance and self-reliance is the overarching umbrella that men and boys are grown up, have grown up with. And that kind of determines all of this. And that strength, and if we look at it like, you know, the ordinary man or boy on the street, you know, maybe most likely is disenfranchised from many of the economic spheres or economic decision making or the political decision making. Where is that area that they can actually exert their dominance over? So if you're a powerful man and you have many resources, Dashan, you're running a corporation and you're the CEO, you have like so many things you can exert your dominance over.
Right.
But if you're a boy on the street, who can you exert your dominance over while this ideal is held over you? And that's how it manifests over like, you know, what's the size of my penis? What kind of car can I drive, perhaps? And how many women I can have?
It's definitely culturally enforced. And when something is culturally enforced, it also, you know, requires institutions. So whether these are familial institutions, the way we're brought up, the differences in the home, son preference in particular, and also, you know, throughout the whole reproductive cycle, when we grow up, adolescent stage, and as young adults, and so on and so forth. So what makes, you know, these constructs harmful is that they rely or they foreground systems of domination, so to speak.
Let's talk about how toxic masculinity affects women. So there's a United Nations global study in 2018, and it found that men and boys who adhere to rigid views of gender roles and masculinity are more likely to use violence against a partner. Why is this so?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, this can come from a few different places, right? So one is the way that we are brought up, that we, you know, exert our dominance and our control by physically controlling the person, right? So that violence becomes a reminder of one of my physical strength over you. So it's not only men to women, but also men to children or women to children or, you know, and what we've also seen in the household, right, against helpers in the household. You know, so this kind of violence is actually used to kind of remind people within your son who's who, where you stand in that hierarchical ladder. So if a man who does not have any control over his workplace, he doesn't have any control over his lending institutions, I mean, his banks, you know, people whom he owes money to, he has no power to make economic decisions or political decisions. So the only person he can effect his control over is basically inside his house.
And it's not just women who are being affected by this, because, Sharon, there are people who say, you know, labeling certain boys will be boys' behavior as toxic are hurting men, you know, hurting their manhood. But do correct me if I'm wrong. The reality is we as a society hurt boys when we reinforce toxic masculinity. In America, for example, men are 3.5 times more likely to die from suicide than women. And this is the same statistic in most countries around Asia too. In Malaysia, the rough suicide rates per 100,000 people is 7.8 among men and only 3.2 among women. That's more than twice the amount. So why is this so? How can toxic masculinity that a lot of people don't want to acknowledge is a real thing, how can it hurt men? Why is it hurting men?
As much as it's hurting men, Dashran, it's also benefiting men. I mean, when we talked about, you know, systems of domination and subordination, that relates directly to male privilege. And in other contexts, white supremacy, and how are these linked? Because we have notions of hegemonic masculinity. What that simply means is that not all men are equal. So at the top of the, at the apex of what is a pyramidal structure, you would find, you know, the most powerful type of men, which Sivananti alluded to earlier. And so generally in the global scheme of things, this would mean generally a white man, you know, straight and somebody with enough social cultural capital. And then you go down the list would be, for instance, a gay identifying man or a man of color. And right at the bottom, you would have masculinity that's associated with other than, you know, male bodies. So, for instance, female masculinity. So not all masculinities are equal.
Now, I wholeheartedly agree with that, but I also don't think we should scoot over the fact that toxic masculinity is something that can really, really hurt men as well. Toxic masculinity is a concept that can put unnecessary and unfair pressure on men to behave a certain way, and this in turn can cause things like depression, for example.
I agree wholeheartedly with what Sharon says, but I can also see your point of view because, you know, earlier on you talked about a very interesting concept. I didn't actually think that being stoic was actually necessarily a toxic masculinity type of value. But I think that comes from the place that, you know, that boys are, you know, I mean, one of those things that people tell boys, right? Don't show your emotions. If you show your emotions, you are vulnerable. And if you're vulnerable, people can hurt you, or rather, actually what it means is people can dominate you. So don't get yourself into that situation where people can dominate you. So if you grow up from a time, at a very young age, you're told to repress your emotions, you know, you become a number of things. Depression, psychological problems are one of those many things that are manifestation of that, right? So definitely it does happen. And the other thing you talked about, suicide. So of course, suicide is like the end outcome, right? But we can also look at other forms like substance abuse and as also one of the manifestations of how this toxic masculinity affects boys, right? So why is it that boys become more likely to do risk-taking behavior and involve themselves in substances at a rate that women don't or girls don't? And these are the reasons why we need to unpack and say, you know, how am I affected? And how has, you know, society shaped into their expectations of me? And how far am I from reaching those expectations and how does that feel, right? So the first thing is we always look at ourselves and look and say, well, I'm not good enough. You know, right. Very rarely do people, young people at an age of like 12 or 13 or 14 and say, hey, it's not because I'm not good enough, but the system is wrong, right? That takes many, many years. And in order to get there, you need to have survived those risky years of like 12 to 21 or so and gotten yourself to a place where you can actually begin to unpack some of those early, molding that you might have received, you know, and remake yourself.
Now let's pivot into the kind of backlash that the phrase toxic masculinity tends to get. Because I keep wondering, why do so many people think that the fight against toxic masculinity is an attack on men? For example, if you look at the Gillette commercial that came out a couple of years ago, titled We Believe the Best That Men Can Be, you know, it has 1.5 million dislikes on YouTube compared to the 800,000 likes, with loads of people in the comments saying that they're going to boycott the company for essentially just creating a commercial where men say that we can be better, that masculinity can veer into this toxic zone and we shouldn't let it veer into the toxic zone. But there are a lot of people who think that by saying that you're attacking the male species or attacking the men, you know, the gender of men in general. And it's not just guys who are saying that. You see, you know, someone like Meryl Streep who comes out and says, we hurt our boys by calling something toxic masculinity because women can be very toxic as well. It should be toxic people.
This is typically the backlash against feminism. Or any ism that questions hierarchical structures, that questions, you know, systems of domination and subjugation. And I guess the way forward would be firstly to recognize that it's essentially a harmful way of being and a harmful way of becoming and definitely a harmful way of a very reductionist way of relating to one another. And it's very easily seen as an attack on men, but that's, you know, a little bit myopic, but it's very easily read as an attack on men, just like, you know, feminism, trying to, you know, affirm and uplift women is seen an attack on men because it's questioning the status quo. Mm. It's questioning a status quo that is founded on, putting, you know, boxing people in their place. So here it comes right down to what many people believe you're born with. And it's a point that I made at the start of the interview. And that is when masculinity is aligned only with maleness, you know. So many people through the years, through the different, you know, cycles of their personhood, sort of shape, you know, their whole gender identity, their whole gender expression on these constructs. And so when these are questioned, let alone challenged, let alone deconstructed, you know, many people would react in a hostile way, in a very aggressive way, because it's akin to having the rug pulled out of your feet. So already where there are deep insecurities, because, you know, systems like this don't actually affirm, they don't actually lift or build up, but people don't recognize that. And so there are deep insecurities that are already inherent, and these are aggravated, you know, these are aggravated when these systems start to be challenged. But I also want to say very quickly that I used to also work at Arrow, Sivananti, and we also looked at, you know, we also looked at the inverse, you know, of toxic masculinity. So some of the best practices in dealing with sexual and gender-based violence actually come from, you know, programs and policies that involve men. So the whole notion of male involvement. And it's very, very powerful when you have boys speak out against SGBV, for instance. So I just want to put it out there that, you know, this is not about male bashing. I think this is a very healthy conversation that we're having because we should, you know, have a look at the way that we are raising, you know, sons and daughters because these are going to be persons of tomorrow and leaders of tomorrow. And there's so much room actually to shape shift. You know what, people don't realize that.
So I just want to also build on what Sharon said. In the European countries, I mean, domestic violence just became, is just not about the law. It's when men themselves found it unacceptable as an idea for a man to beat his wife, right? So that's when you've got the social norm. So, of course, I'm not saying it doesn't ever occur, but, you know, those are generally considered even by society as a deviation from the norm.
Right.
So, but I think that in Gillette, sometimes I feel like, you know, sometimes these are great campaigns, but there's also a timing for that campaign. So I think that it came at a time of the Me Too movement, if I'm not mistaken, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think that the dialogue was still ongoing, you know. So I think that that's where the backlash, to an ad campaign is not necessarily a backlash to an idea itself. And I think that after what happened and after Me Too is that there's greater awareness about the kind of perils at the workplace that lie in for women, you know, so to speak, but also that what rights of women at work look like. And I think that, you know, the immediate backlash does not actually mean a long-term backlash against the issue, because I feel that there's been greater credence given to the idea and laws around sexual harassment and all different forms of sexual harassment as well, right? Things like stalking and all, which are gaining greater traction in this time and age, you know. So I feel like that's still present. But the other thing is, when you look at backlash, you know, what does it actually talk about the societies that we live in? Is that there's actually greater polarization. So you have at one point, you know, more young women who identify themselves as feminists. And then there is another entire segment of society which is actually kind of aligning themselves to this type of toxic masculine figures. And, you know, I mean, like, we talk about resources and command of resources, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at Putin as a politician, you know, look at the way he portrays himself, this man who goes swimming in the dead of winter, right? So that strong man who's riding horses, who's shooting guns. I mean, right. That's how he reflects himself to the public. And his, I mean, so-called, I mean, we don't know exactly whether 100% popularity rates, but he's been there as a strong man forever, right, in Russia, alternating between prime minister, president, and God knows what other roles there are politically for him. So I think we need to look at, study deeper and say, what is it that is driving this idealization of this behavior? Mm. But while we are faced with this extremely polarized electorate, how do we make decisions around policies, and how do we actually change the system or recreate that system?
Just one last quick question before we wrap up. Final thoughts. What are the small steps that we can take as a society to put an end to toxic masculinity? Sharon?
Okay, small step. Having a conversation like this. And I guess having more conversations like this in varied places. But definitely starting from the home. And, you know, to sort of, I hope to see this, that we become a society that really, really is far more inclusive, far more forgiving. And I guess, just to put it out there, people don't realize that as long as these are constructs, they are organic, they are constantly evolving. And I hope that, you know, for those who are already groundbreaking, who are already striking out, that, you know, they're not going to be punished. So it's a very idealistic, fairly romanticized view, but one can only hope.
Yeah, I think, you know, Sharon's statement is like really very true, because, you know, where do we actually learn our roles first? And that's inside the family and inside the home. And if we can help unpack that, is something that is a very big step, I think, we can actually take. It's not a small step, because, I mean, I'm a parent, and I feel like as a parent, you're, I guess you could be set against some sort of ideal, right, of being in control and allocating resources and playing favorites and stuff like that. But I think it's also for us to like kind of be always vigilant and to say that, you know, the next generation has something to teach us by asking us questions. So I think if elders in our society started listening to young people and what they were saying, that's one way of doing it. And, you know, this is why I think like things like Undi 18 make a difference. So we are called to relearn what we know of the world, that it is not working for the next generation. So that would be like the conversation I think we should also encourage.
On that note, Sharon, Sivanandi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Dasharan.
I enjoyed that.
That was Sharon A. Bong, an Associate Professor of Gender Studies at Monash University, and Sivanandi Thanindaran, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, also known as ARRO. And we were having a discussion on toxic masculinity. So if you missed any part of this conversation or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out our podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, Spotify, or even Apple Podcasts. Just search for BFM Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Dasharan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn in the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.